please the court, does Norma Bento intend to present our report?
Thank you and good morning. As you've been told, I am Norma Bento. I practice for Warren Burnett in Odessa and Galveston, Texas, and I'm here today representing the petitioner, Mary Pearl Mundell Stott, whom I have referred to as the widow Stott as opposed to the mother Stott for purposes of simplicity. This is a workers' compensation death case in which the widow Stott, the petitioner here, won a jury verdict in Ector County, Texas. The judge awarded us lump sum attorney's fees. Texas Employers Insurance Association appealed, complaining of this award of lump sum attorney's fees. The Court of Civil Appeals in El Paso reversed and remanded that part of the judgment, holding that this was a dispute between beneficiaries within the meaning of Article 8306, Section 8D. We appeal from that ruling. The question here is quite simply whether that statute does apply to our case. We contend that it does not for two reasons. The simplest reason is that this was a jury verdict. By its terms, 8306, Section 8D, applies upon settlement of all cases where the carrier admits liability for the death, but a dispute exists to the proper beneficiary. In those kinds of cases, then the attorney is supposed to be paid periodically and not in a lump sum. Of course, this very question has not been ruled upon, but the first paragraph of 8306, Section 8D, which applies to widows and children, and tells when they're going to be paid in a lump sum or when they have to be paid periodically, provides for two instances where the widows and the children can be paid in a lump sum, and that is upon settlement in cases where there's a bona fide issue of liability, and upon the remarriage of the widow. And there are two cases which I've cited in my brief, Walden versus Royal Globe Insurance Company and Walters versus Fidelity and Casualty Company, which hold that settlement under those circumstances means exactly what all we lawyers think it means, and that is not a verdict, a settlement between the parties. And surely this was not any sort of a settlement. The second reason that this Article 8306, Section 8D, does not apply to our case is that we contend this is not a case where Texas Employers Insurance Association tendered its money, laid down, and admitted liability. They fought us tooth and toenail from the very beginning. At the board level, the Industrial Accident Board awarded death benefits to the widow Stott, our client, denied benefits to the mother Stott. And from that award, it was not the mother who appealed the case. It was Texas Employers Insurance Association. And indeed, the case was in the posture of TEIA versus the widow Stott for some 9 months before the mother Stott ever appeared in the case. And during this 9 months, the lawyers for Texas Employers Insurance Association took the deposition of our client, the widow Stott. They had filed pleadings denying liability on the grounds that another sort of condition or disease was the sole cause of this man's death, or that his on-the-job injury was not a producing cause of his death. And they took the deposition in that posture. And then some 13 days before the trial, the mother Stott mysteriously appears in the case. And then the day of the trial, Texas Employers Insurance Association files its first amended original answer and interpleader. And in the one and the same pleading, they continue to deny things like wage rate, They are still asserting that some other disease was the sole cause of this man's death. They are still asserting that his on-the-job injury was not a producing cause of his death. But then they file an interpleader in which they tender the accrued benefits into the registry of the court. We will be the first to tell you that this case, when it was tried, when we started trying it that morning, at that point became only a dispute between the beneficiaries. Though Texas Employers was still in the case, still arguing, and still not behaving like a stakeholder and taking part in the oral arguments to the jury. And it's obvious why they wanted the mother to win, since the mother is limited to the 360 weeks under the Act. And our question is, when can a carrier admit liability? Can they put us to this kind of work in investigating and preparing a case and then come in the days of a trial, admit liability, and foreclose us from getting the lump sum attorney's fees? And our contention is that this outrages the purpose of the law and that we had to work every bit as hard as we would have in a disputed liability case, and it was a disputed liability case until the day of the trial. Does the court have any questions?
I have one. In the brief to us, it's not mentioned. The Court of Appeals opinion mentioned very prominently the fact that there was no finding of accident in the scope and course. Was that a point to the Court of Civil Appeals on the part of the TEI?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the question.
Well, in TEIA's brief to the Court of Civil Appeals, they have a point of error to the effect that there was no jury finding, no fact finding of accident in scope and course of employment.
No, sir. There certainly wasn't such a finding. And it is apparent from the statement of facts that we did try this as a case in which they had admitted liability the day of the trial, and we did not ask for such findings.
That's the only question I have. Thank you.
Then
is the Court of Appeals opinion wrong when it says that the amended answer denied liability?
No, they are not wrong. The amended answer did deny liability. They filed two pleadings at once. They filed their amended answer where they're still denying liability on those questions of sole cause and not the producing cause. But at the same time, they filed their interpleader. And it was an informal understanding that morning as we went to trial with those kind of pleadings on record that we were going on a case between the beneficiaries.
But there was no stipulation in the record that the amended answer was being abandoned?
I don't believe so.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Ms. Catherine Gernot, who will present argument for the
May it please the court. Please excuse my voice and my cold. My name is Catherine Gerhauser, and I'm the attorney for Texas Employers Insurance Association, who's the respondent in this cause. And the factual background as presented by the attorneys for the petitioner is essentially accurate. This was a dispute among the beneficiaries for payment of workers' compensation benefits as a result of the death of Daniel Stock. It is also true that Texas Employers Insurance Association exercised its right to appeal the award of the Industrial Accident Board timely and instituted this originally as an issue as to liability. And it is also true that the mother of the deceased intervened and came into this case along with the widow in this benefits case. There was essentially not any discussion here about the amount of the payment to the widow's side or to the proper beneficiary as determined by the jury. And there's not any discussion of the amount of the payment to the attorneys in this case. The trial court awarded 25% of everything that the beneficiary would receive to the attorneys. And the attorneys were as compensated as possible under the directives of the Workers' Compensation Act. Essentially, what is before the court here is the method of payment of attorney's fees. And as regard this, there are two competing rules, and they're set forth, as the court is aware, in Article 8306, Section 8A, excuse me. And there are two separate paragraphs which presume to make a distinction between two separate kinds of cases. The first paragraph of Section D discusses a case where the widow and the insurance company have locked horns in litigation over the liability for the worker's death and whether or not her entitlement to proceeds is at issue. The second paragraph involves cases where there's a bona fide dispute as to beneficiaries. Excuse me, there's not necessarily bona fide, there is just a dispute as to beneficiaries and where the carrier admits liability for the death. Now, while it is true that Texas Employers Insurance Association did contest the liability, it is the respondent's position that it's their right to contest liability absent any particular statutory directive limiting same as far as awarding lump sum attorney fees. If the, in fact, the statute specifically speaks to a different treatment of attorney's fees at different stages of a proceeding, even in a disputed beneficiary case. In Article 7D, or Section 7D of Article 8306, it says that if the carrier admits liability at the board level, there is no attorney's fees whatsoever. And therefore, it sets up one rule for admission of liability at the board level, and it's our position that if they admit liability at the trial court level, there is another computation of attorney's fees. There is no question that the carrier admitted liability in this, even though there may be some contradictions in their pleadings. It was filed as a sole pleading, and there are contradictory allegations. However, the statement of facts shows that all counsel, even before presentation of voir dire, got together and agreed that this was only a case among beneficiaries. There was no evidence as to any of the disputed liability issues. There was no evidence as to any other matter except for the existence of the proper beneficiary entitled to compensation benefits. There was no objection to the filing of the interpleader, and there was no jury issue as to anything but the existence of a common law marriage between Daniel Stott and Mary Pearl Mundell Stott. It's respondent's position that this is precisely what the statute contemplates. And this court has the historical and sometimes unenviable responsibility of determining what the legislature meant when it enacted certain statutory provisions. And we are asserting that in this case, what the legislature intended was that when the carrier settles this issue as to liability and the case goes on, by using the word but, it presupposes the continuing existence of a dispute among the beneficiaries. Where the carrier admits liability is it effectively has settled any responsibility and also any control over the course of the litigation. Again, it doesn't affect the total amount that the court can grant in terms of attorney's fees. It only regulates the payment of attorney's fees. And it says specifically that when the carrier settles, and there is often settlement of parts of litigation that may go on and proceed to verdict, and when the carrier settles its issue of liability and the dispute continues to exist among the beneficiaries, that both the beneficiaries and the attorneys are paid on a periodic basis. And we submit that this is really the only possible interpretation that gives any logic or meaning to the statute. I suppose it's not my position or duty to diagram sentences on how the legislature had intended to operate the statute, but any other interpretation of the statute really renders it meaningless.
When you tendered the money, which you never did tender the money, you made an offer to
It was, Your Honor, it was in fact tendered into the court, the benefits up to the date of trial, and subsequent to then, the carrier tendered all of the payments. And in fact, there are no payments now being tendered, Mrs. Stott having remarried sometime in March, I believe. So at the time of the interpleader, the benefits were tendered, and on the day of trial, and the carrier continued to tender the weekly benefits as they accrued as promptly as they could. There is no case of any refusal to pay, I believe.
Why did the carrier argue during the case? What was the purpose of that?
Well, I'm somewhat of a loss to tell you since I wasn't present at the trial of the matter. Our law firm was fired on the appellate matter, not at the trial. I suppose that the carrier, this question may be better directed to the counsel for petitioner since she was present, whether the carrier was entitled to argue as to who it believed was the proper beneficiary. The record discloses that the carrier put on no evidence as far as any of the issues that would ultimately affect it as far as liability, and that is in compliance with the statute, which then effectively settled all of its issues as to liability.
Well, it would affect the amount of liability, though, wouldn't it?
That's correct, but the second paragraph only talks about whether the carrier admits liability for the death, and in fact, by its interpleader, it did admit liability for compensation benefits as a result of Daniel's death. The statute is silent as to whether or not it has any duty or any right to go and put on evidence as to who it believes the proper beneficiary would be. I would assume that, although it wasn't assigned anywhere there, I assume that the trial court made the determination that the carrier could, in fact, argue as to who it believes is the proper beneficiary. I suppose in retrospect, it probably has no more force than the man on the street determining who it was. But they did not take any part in representing the widow in this case. She was represented by her own counsel, is my understanding.
Your position that y'all admitted liability?
Yes, I believe that we did admit liability and that the record discloses that from the very beginning, in fact, I think it's the first page of the statement of facts forward, that there was no question. And the Court of Civil Appeals is accurate in its opinion when it says that everyone believed that the carrier admitted liability, and they tried it solely as a disputed beneficiary case.
Is it also your position that y'all admitted into a settlement based on that admission of liability in this case?
I believe that the carrier did everything it could to settle. It essentially gave up any right it had to dispute any issue as to its own responsibility for compensation benefits, and therefore settled any cause of action it might have or any of its own rights as far as the litigation is concerned.
Well, the first sentence of the second paragraph, though, is that your position it encompasses only an admission of liability or that it also includes settlement on that admission of liability?
It is, it's a difficult paragraph to interpret. And if it is interpreted that way, it could possibly mean that all parties have to settle before the paragraph becomes operative.
Well, the case really turns on the word settlement here, doesn't it, rather than admission of liability?
Well, it turns on that as well as whether or not the paragraph is going to be applied consistently, I suppose, that the carrier did settle its liabilities and to make the rest of the paragraph make sense, I suppose. That is really the only definition that could be given to it. I recall in my law school career suffering the ignominy of having my property professor, William French, diagram one of my sentences on the blackboard before the class, and I certainly don't presume to be a grammarian about what the particular paragraph means. However, even if it's construed to mean that the settlement means that all parties settle, and only in that event, that would attorney fees be awarded periodically. It seems that the court should also require that where the insurance carrier settles and the case receives the verdict under the second paragraph, that attorney fees also be awarded in a lump sum to give consistency to the statute and also to assure that the attorney's interests in protecting the rights of the claimant and its own interests in seeking its fees do not diverge. This court, in determining 1973 whether or not lump sum benefits could be paid to an attorney while the claimant was paid periodically. In the Motley case, went into a long discussion about making sure that the attorney's interests were not adverse to its clients. And if the court allows the attorney for a disputed beneficiary to receive lump sum if it goes to trial, and as the statute requires, that they only be they only receive periodic payment if they settle, there may arise a possible conflict of interest between the attorney's interest in receiving his fee in a lump sum and his client's interest in possibly settling what might not be a strong case. If the attorney believed that the only way that he could get a lump sum recovery would be to take the case to verdict, he may not serve his his client's interest by trying the case, and thereby in settling it, knowing that he's only going to receive a periodic payment. The Motley case did speak to that issue, that it is one of the purposes of interpreting the act that the interests of the attorney and the interests of his client don't diverge at any point, and therefore, even if the court assumes that only in one instance that attorney's fees be paid periodically, that by inference should also mean that they should not be paid in the lump sum if the case goes to verdict, thereby avoiding a conflict. In summary, the respondent's position is first that the only logical interpretation of the second paragraph of Section 8D is that the carrier is settling its responsibilities, its liability for the debt, and becomes a stakeholder, thereby losing control of the litigation entirely. having lost the control of the litigation entirely, it's entitled to rely on the specific legislative enactment that requires the claimant's attorney to be paid periodically along with the claimant. That is the settlement. The respondent submits that the statute contemplates, and even if the statute could somehow be construed to mean a settlement of all parties on a coincidental settlement, a tripartite settlement, that in the interest of consistency and harmony, that the Supreme Court should require that the attorney's fees be paid in the same manner, notwithstanding settlement verdict. Again, an issue is not how much the attorneys were paid. The attorneys for the claimant in this case were paid the maximum allowed under the statutes under 7D and under the second paragraph of Article of Section 8D. The question is purely the manner of payment, and the legislature has specifically, as it has not done in any other case, mandated that the payments be made periodically. We submit that the trial court erred in lump sum attorney's fees in this particular situation, as the Court of Appeals is right in reversing that and requiring the payment to be made on a periodic basis. For those reasons, we respectfully pray that this court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear reply from the petitioner.
I don't believe much reply is necessary. I think the issues are fairly well drawn, but I would like to point out to this court that if Texas Employers Insurance Association had come in as a stakeholder when they appealed this case from the Industrial Accident Board, that we would have had our money in May of 1980, that they would have thought that, excuse me, the mother did not appeal this award, and that she didn't come into this case for 9 months and not until 13 days before the trial. If they had wanted to settle, it would have been quite easy to have been a stakeholder then. And I just simply ask if there are any other questions with me.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel in the second cause will please come to counsel's table. Dutcher versus Ted Owens.
Yeah, please go up to the left and show what you said.
May I proceed in the absence?